This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
A killer smile. Truer words were never spoken. A surgeon dazzles. He beams this megawatt smile on the dating apps just before he travels nearly 400 miles to gun down his ex-wife and her new husband, according to police. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us. Michael McKee, the vascular surgeon, multiple malpractice and claims against him. Something pushed him over the edge. Both of the Tepes are dead, Spencer and Monique.
Spencer had been shot twice, Monique once.
The children are orphans. They probably will remember the murders of their parents. I watched their wedding video over and over and over preparing for tonight. And as I was watching it, looking for anything probative in the video, which I found, by the way, I wondered how many times vascular surgeon Dr. Michael McKee went over and over and over that wedding video. They were married and murdered in the same home. Married and murdered in the same home. This as the defendant, the vascular surgeon, awaiting extradition on multiple counts that have just been handed down. We uncover his dating apps. I mean, I can't wait to get a hold of his digital footprint. Now think about it. This is according to police. He's on these dating apps, pouring out his soul about how he wants to have children, how he loves hot yoga. And then he's watching her. There he is with a slew of lawsuits he's facing, including one guy with an amputated testicle, another with a catheter shard stuck in his leg. He's talking about on the dating apps how he wants children, how he wants to settle down, yet he's all alone. I wonder why. Looking at her wedding video. How many nights did he hunch over his computer screen watching Monique joyful in that wedding video, posting photos of her pregnant in front of the Christmas tree as he drones on dating websites about how he wants children one day? That said, now we learn about a silencer. Come on, I can't wait for the defense attorney, bring it on, to tell me this was not premeditated. Do you know how difficult it is to get your mitts on a silencer, or as it is called in the business, a suppressor? Listen.
Michael McKee, indicted on 4 counts of aggravated murder in the deaths of his ex-wife, Monique Tepe, and her husband, Spencer. The indictment specifies that the firearm used by McKee was equipped with a muffler or suppressor, commonly called a silencer. McKee also faces an additional charge of aggravated burglary for allegedly breaking into the Tepe home to commit the murders.
Joining us, an all-star panel to make sense of what we are learning tonight. That should run a chill down your spine. Common knowledge, common belief, is that suppressors, silencers, are illegal. You can't get one. Maybe a mobster or a dope lord. That is not true. You can get them legally. As a matter of fact, just recently, a bill was passed in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night. Now, nothing good happens after midnight. Why is a House of Congress passing a bill in the middle of the night? Does that sound sneaky? It does to me. Because what they did was take away a $200 surcharge on buying silencers. So now anybody can have them, including, according to police, this brilliant vascular surgeon, Michael McKee. Oh, excuse me. On the dating websites, he says, call me Mike. You know what? I'll just call you defendant. Straight out to Joseph Scott Morgan, Professor of Forensics, Jacksonville State University, author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon, star of a hit new podcast series, Body Bags with Joe Scott Morgan, but for my purposes, death investigator. What can you tell me about silencers as it's a vernacular for suppressors?
You know, Nancy, one of the fascinating things about suppressors, because contrary to what people think, they are not silencers. You cannot knock down in totality, a supersonic round. That means a round that actually travels at the speed of sound or higher. It does knock it down a few decibels. Now, here's the interesting thing. When you purchase a suppressor, and it's suppressing the sound, right, you have to be registered with the ATF. So the ATF absolutely has a record of this, unless this is something that was either purchased on the black market or something that he built, which people can do these. But here's one of the big keys with this, Nancy. It's not only that he's on the radar relative to the suppressor. You have to have a specific weapon platform. That means the handgun this thing was attached to, Nancy, it's got an external threaded barrel. So if you see someone that takes a suppressor, they have to literally screw it or attach it on. And those weapons are very specific. So from an investigative standpoint, we're talking about connecting the dots here relative to not just the suppressor, but also the pistol itself.
We are talking about the fact that a suppressor, silencer, was used in the murders of Monique and Spencer Tepe. And to Susan Hendricks joining us, investigative reporter, journalist, and author of a bestseller, Down the Hill, My Descent into the Double Murder in Delphi. Susan, many people didn't know about the allegation a suppressor was used, which requires a lot of forethought, right? You've got to match it to your gun. You've got to set it up. You've got to get it. Who needs a suppressor? Who needs a silencer? We learned about it in this indictment. Tell me about the indictment.
Yeah, Nancy, and that's an excellent point. He did plan it out, according to this indictment, charged with 4 counts of aggravated murder, and 3 counts of the aggravated murder include exactly that, having a silencer. And the fourth one includes just brandishing or showing the firearm. It appears he planned more of what to do rather than the aftermath of it.
We have gotten our mitts on the indictment, and that is where many people learn that a muffler, suppressor, silencer was used. You know, I want to go back to Joe Scott Morgan. How does a silencer work for a layperson, if you could break that down?
Yeah,
and
sure. Yeah.
Would a silencer be registered on NIBIN, the NIBN, which is the National Integrated Ballistics Information. What could you explain how, in lay terms, does a silencer work? Don't get technical. And
I'll try not to.
Would there be a trace of it? Could it be listed on NIBIN?
Okay, let's take how this thing works in the first place. It's if you think about a silencer as like a can, shaped like a can, cylindrical, and you split it down the middle. It's got a series of, and there's different forms, but this is the basics. It's got a series of little baffles or fins that are in it. And so just imagine, if you will, that as that round is traveling down that barrel, okay, the sound of it cracking the sound barrier is actually being caught in these little fins. And so when the thing exits the end of the muzzle, you only have almost it is audible, but it is not like, if anyone has ever been near a weapon when it fires, it's not going to sound like a car backfiring. You might hear something that sounds just under the sound of a slamming door, perhaps. And of course, that's dependent upon the weight of the door. But as this thing travels down range, these little baffles inside the cylinder are catching that report, if you will. Now back to NIBIN. NIBIN is fascinating because most of the time with NIBIN, what they're doing is they're looking for questioned ballistic information. So if someone shot at a scene, they're collecting the casings. Remember back in Delphi where we had the casing that had the striations on it? And also they're collecting the actual projectile as well for the scratches on that surface. Now, as far as NIBIN holding suppressor information, I'd probably say not. However, that thing is managed by the ATF, and all of these suppressors have to go through the approval has to go through the ATF, Nancy.
You know, to Dan Murphy joining us, former NYPD detective sergeant, conducted hundreds of interrogations and investigations, co-host of a hit podcast, Gold Shields, and author of Workplace Safety. Dan, thank you for being with us. What goes through your mind, just off the top of your head, when you go to a crime scene or you arrest someone and you find on their person a silencer?
That person is using it or intending to use it for criminal activity. He wants to mask the sound of the weapon being fired. Now, in this case, we know from the history of the case that there was not much in terms of weaponry heard by people outside. Weapons are very, very loud. Handguns are very loud, especially inside in closed spaces. You're talking about 140 decibels as possible, which is louder than the loudest rock concert you've ever been to. So that sound would alert people on the outside. The presence of a silencer indicates somebody typically wants to use it in a way that no one would know he had used it. It would not be alerting people outside or in the vicinity.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Joining us now, veteran trial lawyer, former felony prosecutor, now civil and criminal defense attorney, Daryl Cohen. Daryl, thank you for being with us. Daryl, when you were a prosecutor, we would practically dance up and down the halls with glee if we found a silencer on a crime scene. There's nothing good about a silencer, much less if it was in somebody's car, in their backpack, hidden in their trunk, or still attached to the weapon at the crime scene, a silencer. There's nothing good about a silencer. I mean, you see people driving around in pickup trucks. They've got their gun proudly displayed on the right behind them, right? But a silencer, oh, no, no, no. You don't advertise that you're using a silencer. There's nothing good about a silencer.
Nancy, as a prosecutor, I love silencers. That was an additional witness that was saying the owner of this silencer, muffler, suppressor, whatever you want to call it, is guilty. Thank you so much, because I don't have to worry about giving the silencer its rights. I don't have to worry about cross-examination. It is what it is, and it is a fabulous witness. Absolutely. I loved it. Didn't happen often, but when it did, it was terrific.
You know, Daryl Cohen, the first time I had a case with a silencer, it was a drug lord. And it was this beautiful, posh high-rise on Peachtree, right on Peachtree, you know, in front of God and everybody. And as a matter of fact, the co-defendant in that case went on to raid a room, a hotel room with O.J. Simpson, Charlie the Tuna, Charles Ehrlich. It was his place. We performed a search, and there was a silencer. I had never had one in a case. I knew it meant a drug lord. I knew it meant somebody in the mob. That's what, who uses silencer, and there it was. I couldn't believe it. And it spoke volumes, just as you said. Now, put on your defense attorney hat. Why does this vascular surgeon have a silencer? Why?
Nancy, I would advise my client, if he was my client, KYD BMS, keep your damn big mouth shut. Because there's no excuse to have a silencer. There's no reason to have a silencer. There's no reasonable explanation to have a silencer. Unless, of course, you didn't want people to know, or anyone outside of the immediate target area, the crime scene, to know what's going on. So that's why, as a silencer, if he was my client, I would keep his mouth shut and I would try to dance around and ignore the silencer. And when the direct evidence came out, the direct questions to law enforcement, I would ask them no questions. Because in this case, less is more.
Well, Daryl, I thought your first move would be to try to have it suppressed.
Well, of course.
Oh, that was an illegal search. Blah, 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 blah. Fruit of the poisonous tree. Blah, 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 blah. Aren't you going to try to get this thing thrown out so the jury never finds out about it?
Of course.
It's in the indictment.
But I'm making the assumption that Judge X, whoever is presiding over the trial, is going to say, thank you very much. I appreciate that motion to suppress, but overruled.
You know what, Daryl Cohen, in those crime scene photos, the drug lord that had the high rise, like 500 feet down from where Elton John had his high rise on Peachtree Street, in the crime scene photo, there was a suppressor beside a giant dildo. Okay. And the defense tried really hard to keep that out. But, oh, I had to have it in evidence to show the suppressor. Okay. So that said, this suppressor is going to come in to evidence. And I don't care what you or any other defense attorney tries to do, how many somersaults you turn and cartwheels and backbends. It's coming in. She probably heard that muffled sound Joe Scott Morgan was describing as he, McKee, according to police, shoots her husband in bed and then shoots her. Yeah, it's coming into evidence. Listen.
Multiple weapons were taken from the property of McKee. And there is a preliminary link from our NIBIN to one of the weapons that ties it to the homicides.
Local and Columbus police in and out of McKee's 12th floor Chicago apartment with boxes of potential evidence, lugging it down to a Columbus PD crime lab van in the underground garage. Residents receive a notice authorities will be investigating over several days, and they shouldn't be concerned by the officer posted outside McKee's door. Preliminary testing leads them to believe one of those weapons is connected to the Tepe's murders.
Did you find any other evidence in his home in Lincoln Park?
What I can tell you is that we did search his property and we have evidence, but I can't speak to any specific evidence.
Okay, Joe Scott Morgan, lightning round. First of all, can a silencer, I don't know, would a silencer have any markings on it from the bullet and vice versa?
Not necessarily. It would be benign at best. As a matter of fact, silencers actually, there's some studies that indicate silencers increase the velocity of the round, if you can imagine that. No, the key to this, Nancy, is going to be the internal barrel of this weapon. And Nancy, whatever they found there, they took those weapons immediately. As soon as they got them, they went to the lab and they did preliminary ballistic testing on those weapons. And if he's got multiple calibers and they find, let's say, 9mm shell casings at the scene of the murder, they're going to narrow it down to that one weapon, take it and fire it. And they've got some kind of scientific confirmation in their mind that they've got a match here.
Hey, let me follow up on something that you said that I did not know. You said that silencers in some studies are shown to increase the velocity, the speed of the bullet. Did you say that?
Yes, I did. I sure did.
Yeah. Can you imagine this? Just keep this scene. He gets, according to police, of course, he's innocent until proven guilty under the law. He, according to police, and he's huge now. In fact, when I was doing an online chat the other night when we were covering Tepe, people asked if he had steroided up. And I'm going to show some before and after shots in just a moment. Yeah. But back to what you just said, Joe Scott, him standing, foot of the bed, this is already going to be a close range shot.
Yes.
Which is, you know, tears you up, tears your body up. But with a silencer that increases the velocity at close range?
Yeah, there's a possibility that it could, according to the scientific studies that have been conducted. And a lot of that has to do with the compression that's behind, that's contained within that, some people refer to them as cans, contained within that can that is pressing it down range towards your target area. But here's the thing, and I can't get past this, Nancy. He did this because his kids were in the house. That's why he did it. He didn't want to alert them to this.
I don't know, Joe Scott, that he did it to protect the children. If he had any feeling toward the children, he would not have murdered their mother and their father. I think it was so witnesses like, you see how the houses are close together? Let's see a shot of the neighborhood. There's tall, they're almost like row houses. If he had not had a suppressor, then I think the next door neighbors would have heard it ringing out at 3 a.m. Oh, this video is from our friends at WSYX. Another thing to Dan Murphy, and then I'm going to go to Karen Stark, our shrink, to figure out why he kept all this as a memento. But Dan, we all know that bullets can be traced back to the particular gun. It's like a fingerprint. Mm-hmm. Each gun has its own markings inside the barrel. How does that happen? That happens because when the gun is manufactured, the metal cools, and there are little drippies and droppies in there. And as the bullet hurtles down the barrel at high velocity, it gets striation, markings, skins on it, and it's called striation markings. That bullet and that gun have a 100% ballistics match. No other gun can leave those particular markings, scratches, striations on a bullet. No other gun. Like nobody else has your fingerprint, no other gun can do that. But what people don't know is that casings can be traced back to a gun as well. How?
It has to do with the marking made when the bullet is hit. The round itself is struck, and that causes the explosion inside the round. So the firing pin leaves a mark that is traceable back to a weapon. It is unique.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Joe Scott, what does that firing pin marking look like on the casing? Just tell everyone that's not familiar with ballistics, what is the casing, what is the bullet, and what marking would that firing pin leave on a casing?
Okay, so at the base of a casing, you probably can't see this real clearly, there's actually a primer cap. It's a little concentric area right here. Just imagine a bullseye target. Yeah, that's a great image right there, guys. So if you see that little silver area right there, that pin strike that Dan's talking about, that pin strike is unique to that pin as well, okay? So when that pin is actually milled, as you were referring to it, it strikes that, and it's going to leave a very specific marking behind. There's a couple other areas that we look for. If there's any way you can put that image back up. If you see the kind of rim that's around the outer perimeter of that silver bullseye, when this round, this is a semi-automatic weapon, so when this thing is actually grabbed by the ejector inside of that bullet, inside of the housing, it grabs it, and that's an extractor, and then there's an ejector. So it grabs it, and that eject that grabbing motion makes an impression on that surface, and the ejector, as it's cast out, makes another specific marking. So there's about three different areas just with the casing alone. I'm glad that Dan brought up the pinstripe because most people forget about that. And that's key here. So you've got three points of contact, and we're not even talking about the projectile that they would have recovered either from the bodies or in the adjacent area if it passed through the body.
All that planning and all that plotting, driving through the night, according to what we have learned, he had reserved a bed back at the hospital like he was going to sleep there, sneaks out, travels nearly 400 miles carrying a gun and a suppressor. He didn't know the casings are directly linked back to the gun.
On December 30th, 2025, at approximately 10:04 a.m., Columbus Police Patrol officers were dispatched to the 1400 block of North 4th Street on a well-being check. Officers arrived at scene and located the two adult victims suffering from apparent gunshot wounds. We now know that they were identified as Mr. Spencer Tepe and Mrs. Monique Tepe. Their two small children were also found in the residence, physically unharmed. This was a targeted attack. This was a domestic violence-related attack. As we know, McKee is the ex-husband of Monique Tepe. We can say that we have the suspect's vehicle on neighborhood video surveillance arriving just before the murders and leaving shortly after. Detectives were able to link this vehicle to McKee. The vehicle was located in Rockford, Illinois, and evidence was found that showed McKee in possession of the vehicle before and after the homicide.
The state is building its case against vascular surgeon Dr. McKee. How long did he stalk her? She was terrified because he had threatened her life on multiple occasions when they were married. He brewed and bubbled and simmered and stewed for nearly 10 years. The dating app, his profile. Trying hot yoga. Less flexible than I recall. Well, you're flexible enough to break into a basement window, according to police. Planning trip itineraries, using global entry, hopped on an electric motorcycle. Okay, but before I go to his dating apps, where he's positively beaming a million-dollar smile, I want to finish up about the ballistics. Yes, there's more. and a good prosecutor will delve into every single thing these bullets can prove. Dan Murphy joining us, former NYPD detective sergeant, star of hit podcast Gold Shields and author. Dan, don't you just love when a defendant, a suspect, is so attached to something about the crime scene that they keep it? It could be, I've seen a lot of cases where the killer kept the victim's jewelry, not necessarily to hawk it, to get money from it, to pawn it, because it so intimately identifies with the victim, or a driver's license, or a pair of underwear. It could be anything. Have you ever seen that? And I love it because it's so probative. Like, how would her underwear end up in your sock drawer? You claim you don't even know her.
I've absolutely seen it, Nancy, many times. And it is really a moment where you want to high five yourself at your luck that this person was so attached to this, whatever it represented, whether it's a success in their mind or the fulfillment of...
Okay, wait. Dan, please look at your screen. I know you can't recognize him, but I would know that face anywhere. That's BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill. That's one of the photos where he dressed up, including makeup, a face and wig, and tied himself up and then took a picture of himself.
Right.
But talk about keeping mementos. I'm sorry, I just had to direct your attention to that photo. Continue.
No, I've never had anyone as bad as him with that, but I have had people hold on to identification. I had a whole kidnapping crew and murder crew we caught in California that held the identification of every person they ever kidnapped and tortured. So when we rescued victims...
Whoa, wait. What? Every person? They kept a memento of every person? Oh, I would have had a field day. Just lay each driver's license out the jury rail. Mm-hmm. Just let them sit there and, you know, like, drink it in for the jury. But why do you think, I'm going to go back to Karen Stark, but why do you think, as a seasoned detective with NYPD, why do they keep them? They're damning evidence.
This guy thinks he's so smart that he's not going to get caught. So he's not worried about evidence in court. And sometimes very smart people do very stupid things. But in this case, I have a feeling he just liked the gun. And he figured, I got away with this. Nobody's going to link me to her. We've been divorced for years. He thought he had outsmarted everyone, and he liked that one, and it represented triumph over her.
With me is Dan Murphy, former NYPD detective sergeant, conducted hundreds of homicide investigations, author and co-host of hit podcast Gold Shields. Dan, I want to take what you said and go back to Karen Stark. Karen, I want to talk about this murder weapon. If LE, law enforcement, had not gotten that gun match, that shell casing match, and there's going to be a bullet match, a bullet found either in the bodies, lodged in a mattress, lodged somewhere in that room, maybe in the wall, maybe under the bed. They've got a bullet, all right? But they used the casing first to make the match, probably because the bullet was still being fished out of the bodies at the morgue. If we didn't have that match, we may not have very much. But now we've got a ballistics match. Now, why did he keep the gun? Do you think he put so much love and care into procuring the silencer, matching it with the gun? I wonder if they're going to end up, Karen Stark, finding him on video at some gun shop or find his order online getting a silencer that will marry to a 9mm. That he put so much thought and care into that, but it became like his little pet. I don't have the right words, you do. And holding it, caressing it, looking at it, reminded him of that moment so he could relive the moment. He towered over his ex-wife in her bedroom with her new husband, and he could relive the moment he saw the terror on her face as he killed her husband and then turn the gun on her. Why else keep it, Karen?
Well, Nancy, you absolutely hit it on the head. This is somebody, first of all, he's a narcissist. So he's not thinking about what if I get caught. He's never going to get caught in his mind. But here it is.
He was able to, after all these years, building up resentment, threatening her, he was able to keep the symbol that he was successful in getting back at her and killing her, and he could relive it. He could see, and if you look, think about it, this is also a very organized killer. He's not somebody who went in there, didn't know what he was doing, and all of a sudden decided, well, maybe I'll kill them. He planned the whole thing out. The gun, the silencer, it all shows that this man was meticulous, narcissistic, knew exactly what he was doing, and enjoyed looking at the success, his win over this couple.
Okay, Karen Stark, this is not a pretty picture I'm about to conjure up in your mind, but according to many forensic studies, killers keep mementos for sexual reasons. They will keep a woman's underwear, even her driver's license, her jewelry, even this suppressor and this gun, which is forever connected to, inextricably linked to the murders, for sex fantasies. I don't get you. Masturbate with a gun?
Well, Nancy, let's think about how a gun is often used, symbolized, right? As being
do
a
I
sexual...
have to? I guess I do.
Yep. And all of the men that you mentioned, all the killers that you mentioned, they used their tokens for sexual gratification. They got off on them. They could look at it over and over again and masturbate to it, just as you said. And I have no doubt, because he kept it and held on to it, didn't care if he'd get caught, that he used it the same way. After all, he thought about her for years. He didn't really have another relationship or involvement. She moved on. She was his possession. And now he could look at it and get off on the fact that he had her. He kept her. He killed her. And here's the proof.
Monique and her husband are shot dead. How long did those bodies lie there going cold in pools of blood with their children sitting there with mommy and daddy dead? Her babies in the next room, they're all on one floor. They were screaming their heads off, wailing by their parents' dead bodies.
In a dating profile on Bumble, McKee refers to himself as Mike, claims to be 32, and in the About Me section writes, "Lucky to have work I find meaningful and increased free time for new things. Currently trying hot yoga, way less flexible than I recall. Planning trip itineraries to finally make use of global entry and hopped on an electric motorcycle. Haven't died yet." He also says he wants children someday.
Okay, joining us an all-star panel to make sense now of this guy's dating app. Straight out to Susan Hendricks, investigative reporter and author. Susan, tell me about the dating app. This one is on Bumble, but I imagine where there's one, there are a million, like roaches. You see one, there's 100 of them hiding behind the wall. Guarantee he's on another one I haven't uncovered yet. Tell me about his dating app.
Absolutely. And that aligns, I believe, with who he pretended to be and who he really was. At first, I did a double take thinking, is that the same guy? He looks completely different. All of these hobbies, I'd like to travel, kind of trying to lure women into this, a facade on who he was. But he looks very different to me. And I bet if Monique saw this, she would think, "What? That's not the person I married." And she did tell her close friends and relatives that she was afraid of him. But there he is on the dating app. "I like to travel, like you said, Nancy, hot yoga." It's all BS.
The last thing I want to think about is comparing that hulking frame of his, allegedly lumbering down the alley behind Monique and Spencer's home, with him and a pair of those little shorts that guys wear in hot yoga. I don't even want to think about that. Now, in the dating profile, it paints McKee as a young 32-year-old surgeon. Lie. And it's full of details aimed at women to interest them. 6'2", maybe. He is beaming in the photograph, showing off his tan, suggesting a real outdoorsman, wearing a lilac sweater over a white button-down, posing, for some reason, with a kid's lunchbox which shows the name Mike and a dinosaur. I guess that's because he's Michael and asked people to call him Mike. Meaningful work, increased free time for new things, i.e. you. Hot yoga, less flexible. Well, you know what? According to what we're learning, he climbed in the half window of a basement at ground level. Suggests foreign travel, global entry. You don't have global entry to go from Georgia to Florida. And likes to ride a motorcycle. Does he actually think that's macho? You know, Susan Hendricks, do you know what police call motorcycle drivers? Future organ donors. So a lot of women may not find that dashing and exciting. He goes on and says a pro of dating him is, quote, I've perfected the chocolate chip cookie. What is he doing, Karen Stark? Help me. Now, I promise you, if I saw that, I would be attracted to the chocolate chip cookie part, Karen Stark. He lists art, design, basketball, football, skiing. Location set as L.A. It's not where he was. It's two truths and a lie. I've cycled to, from, that's what he said, Pacific to the Atlantic, went 8 full seconds on rodeo, and drink water when I'm thirsty. Okay, help me out, Karen Stark. All of this is a big lie. Can you imagine the unsuspected women that may have signed up to meet this guy, an alleged double killer?
I'm telling you, Nancy, if you interview a lot of women who go on dating apps, they have to be very careful, and they know it, just because of guys like him. You would think, if you read this, maybe he's a lonely man, and he's really looking for companionship and building up his ego. But the truth is, that is not who he is. He's a man who has wanted revenge for years. He doesn't want to start a new life. He wants to get revenge on the ex-wife. And this is all about building him up. It has nothing to do with being lonely or wanting another person. And you could see it from all the lies he created. This isn't him. This is his image of him.
In his dating app, he talks about how he wants children. But he's alone. He's running from multiple lawsuits, including one guy who had to have his testicle amputated, another guy claiming he had a part of a catheter stuck in his left shard, stuck in his leg, ouch, after surgery. So he's alone, running from lawsuits, running from process servers, and he watches this over and over.
From day one, I knew you were something special. I had quite a journey to get to you. Countless bad Bumble dates, wrong relationships, and waterfalls of tears. But it was worth every cringing second because it led me to you. Throughout all of this, I knew that God was guiding me to my person, and that when I met him, it would be the most magical thing ever. And boy, is that an understatement? I finally found my lobster, and it honestly couldn't be a person with a more beautiful heart. I will love you forever, and I'm so lucky to be Mrs. Teppy.
How many times, Daryl Cohen, will his digital footprint show me? You're the veteran trial lawyer. If he looked at that even once, I get to play it in front of the jury.
That's all we need, Nancy. That's all a prosecutor needs. Actually, less is more. And in this case, one time only, OTO, they got it. The jury, if it goes that far, will have it. And the jury will have everything else. And piece by piece.
And you know what, Daryl? If a portion of the wedding video is played, then the jury has a right to look at the whole thing. Because you can't selectively take bits and pieces. Right?
Absolutely.
So that gives me an evidentiary basis to put in the whole wedding video.
And what are we going to see? A motive for murder. A motive to destroy his ex-wife, to destroy her husband, and at the same time, destroying their kids.
Dear Momo, I feel so lucky to be up here with you today. You've grown to become my best friend, and together, we're surrounded by friends and family who are fortunate to be able to say the same. We're so lucky. Our support system is immense, and you embracing Larry, my crazy group of friends, and my loud family like you have means the world. I vow to support you, to believe in you, and to encourage you. I vow to provide for you. I vow to never stop loving you and to always keep working on us. And lastly, I vow to do my best to always keep making you laugh because your smile is my favorite thing. I love you.
I mean, Daryl Cohen, you said put that up as motive while he's putting on Bumble, I want children, and he's sitting alone eating his TV dinner hunched over one of those trays. Can you even imagine that? And he sees this, that Spencer Tepe, on his wedding day. Spencer and Monique murdered in the same home in which they were married, and that wedding video, which was online, shows you various parts of their home that he could figure out from this. He could figure out the layout of the home. Hey, Daryl, what about when Monique said she was saying that she compared Spencer to countless bad Bumble dates? Bumble? Really? And I've got his Bumble profile? Wrong relationships. Gee, I wonder who she's talking about. Waterfalls of tears. It was worth every cringing second because it led me to you. So has he, McKee, figured out that he's the cringe? And he's got to look at Spencer, who now has, quote, his woman?
Nancy, I don't think there's any question. He figured that out easily. And if he hadn't figured it out, it really wouldn't matter. He saw the video of her wedding, not to him, but to the person who followed him after their contentious divorce, after their horrible marriage. But none of it was his fault. All of it was hers. And he had an obsession with her. And if I can't have you, no one else will. And I promise you that. And not only will no one else have you, but I'm going to take care of, destroy this other person who I have seen in the video. Oh, we have so much. As a defense lawyer, I wouldn't touch him with a 1,000-foot pole. He's nuclear. He is absolutely the worst. But the good thing is...
Hey, Dave Mack, I want to follow up on what Daryl Cohen, trial lawyer, is saying. Speaking of, if I can't have you, no one will, that whole mentality. Isn't it true, Dave Mack, Crime Stories investigative reporter, that in various missives, written missives from McKee to Monique, and this is after their divorce, after they separate, he refers to her as his wife?
He continued to do that, Nancy, to continue to put his arms out there and say, you're mine. Yeah, we're divorced and you're moving on, but you are mine. I could not believe that he was still pushing that in everything that he had. You put that in writing, Nancy, and you're stamping it. It's different than just saying it out loud. He wrote, you're my wife.
After the breakup. Hey, guys, I got to show you one more thing. The video we pulled after the live chat I was doing the other night during our program, someone named at @ROTTRUAI noticed this. Notice the pull to the right. Okay, and we've seen a lot of very distinctive gates, and I've used them in prosecutions. Best example in a bank robbery where a guy was slew-footed. But the viewer was right and noticed it first. See him pull to the right, pull to the right, pull to the right. That's going to come in as evidence. And you know another thing I noticed, Susan Hendricks? Oh, that video is from our friends at WBNS. This guy, McKee, no idiot. He started being on the front page of the paper in the first grade for winning an academic honor, then a presentation to the Secretary of State. Then he went on to play varsity football. He was in the top five, not 5%, but the top five in his class. I mean, this guy is super smart.
Absolutely. And I spoke to a guy who played football with him in high school and talked to him on the phone. He didn't want to be named, but he said that McKee's adoptive parents, he was adopted, were very nice. He was to himself, though, very quiet, doesn't remember him dating at all, kind of to himself. Of course, they were shocked, but smart, highly intelligent. He did say that several times, but really kind of a loner. It stood out to me.
Well, he's making headlines again. As we go to air tonight, he is en route back to home turf. The extradition process is happening to answer up on multiple felony charges. The case is still being built by both the state and the defense. If you know or think you know anything, please dial 614-645-2228. 614-645-2228. McKee, innocent until proven guilty. Nancy Grace signing off. Goodbye, friend. This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.